Hello, and thank you for tuning in to our second podcast in support of our production of What We're Up Against by Teresa Rabeck. My name's Patrick Torres, I'm the Artistic Director here at Raleigh Little Theater, and I thank you for tuning in. On today's episode, Heather Strickland, the director, and I talked to Claire Cunahan, who's with the Women's Center of North Carolina. This conversation was really exciting, and it made me think about the play in a lot of different ways that I hadn't considered before, and so I'm really happy that you're listening to it. If you haven't had a chance to listen to our first podcast, I encourage you to go back and listen to that as we talked to Dr. Sharon Cannon and Heather Strickland and got some good, solid foundational information about the play that I think will help you as you get prepared to see it. But without further ado, here's our interview with Claire Cunahan.
Hi, everybody. So now we're here with Claire Cunahan, who's a program coordinator with the Women's Center of North Carolina, and our director, Heather Strickland. And so I'm really excited about this conversation today. Thank you for joining us. And Claire, I wonder if you can tell us and our listeners just a little bit about you and the work that you do at the Women's Center.
I would be delighted to. So I work at UNC Chapel Hill, where the Women's Center is a resource for faculty, students, and staff, so everybody on campus. And we really are a center for gender equity, so we work with folks of all gender identities, although we end up primarily working with folks who identify as women. In my role, I do what I like to think of in three separate buckets. So in the first bucket, I provide programming that faculty and staff request. That might be anything from we're interested in how you negotiate your salary to what are the policies around parental leave and the other resources and how can I best take advantage of them, to the second bucket, which I like to think of as helping the university be more gender equitable. And in that context, I help folks think about if they're writing policies, how those policies might play out in terms of gender equity, if folks are thinking about bringing on board new resources, whether those resources are going to meet the needs of all members of the campus. And then the third bucket is basically kind of general question and answering. If folks have questions related to gender equity at the university, I am happy to answer them in whatever way I can. Sometimes that means outsourcing to somebody who is an expert. Sometimes that means doing a lot of Googling. But I usually somehow come up with something that gets that question answered.
Great, thank you. That sounds amazing. It's so great that there's that resource, on campus.
It's been really, really fun, and I have to say, really rewarding.
And so now here you are in the world of theater with us, and Heather, tell us a little bit about how you got Claire on board. I know you've worked with her before, but tell us a little bit about how you two have worked together.
Yeah, so I met Claire a couple of years ago when I was first looking at doing an all-female version of Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus. And a mutual friend had connected us because I had an interest in really better understanding, what were some of the issues that women faced in relationships with each other and how were women holding each other down potentially and in many cases even more than men were. And so Claire and I had some really eye-opening and insightful initial conversations. Claire also came in and did a whole conversation with my cast to really think through kind of how that played out in their everyday lives and what they did understand about the challenges that women faced in their relationships with each other. And then also participated in a post-show panel with me to add an extra layer of perspective to the work that we were doing. So when I was handed this script, and certainly was looking at, again, talking about inequities that women specifically faced, one of the first phone calls that I made was to Claire to say, I need your help again, because she was such a fabulous resource the last time, not only for me, but for everyone that was involved in that show.
I had so much fun, so the feeling is mutual.
Oh, good. So now she's my go-to. So anytime somebody hands me a script that has to do about a women's issue, Claire's will be involved with me.
Excellent.
Great. So why don't we talk about just get Claire's insight into the play.
Absolutely. So Claire, I think I sent this script to you maybe a few months ago, certainly very early on when I was thinking about it. Tell us about what your immediate thoughts were upon reading it.
I have to admit, it was a combination of despair, but also excitement. Despair in that the events, the interactions that the script represents and depicts are so familiar. And in some sense, there's this wish that we could say, no, that's how it was back then. Mm-hmm. But as current events are definitely revealing to us, that is how it continues to be. I think one of the things that I found really powerful about the script was how it indicates that sexual harassment isn't always necessarily about the sexual part of it, but that the harassment can take place in many, many different ways, that it can be about disregarding somebody's knowledge or not being comfortable with them holding authority, sidelining them, and the way that it creates multiple kinds of dynamics within a workplace that everybody is involved in, that this kind of workplace harassment isn't just limited to the two individuals who you would think are, you know, the perpetrator and the victim of the harassment, that everybody is somehow both participating in, but also suffering from that power inequity.
So because I know that I had a similar initial reaction to reading the script too, and part of what was a little surprising to me is that, you know, I was reading the script and the sexism seemed so overt in the story that we were telling, and I had that kind of initial thought of, oh, it's not this bad. But then as I thought more and more about it, I was recalling instances in my own life where I was like, oh no, this does happen. Maybe not in this perfect, neat hour and a half of the story that we're telling, but yes, these are real things. I'm curious about kind of how that sort of evolved as you were thinking more about the story.
Well, I think your experience really speaks to the ways in which, well, two things. First of all, the ways in which women specifically, but folks in any kind of marginalized identity, are trained to dismiss their own experiences, whether it's through the fear of not being believed when they share those experiences with coworkers, with friends, with family, or the fear of their own misperception, like, did that really happen? Mm-hmm. That there's this kind of consistent message that what happened to you didn't really happen. And so there's this moment of recognition when you're like, oh, wait, that experience that I had 15 years ago, 5 years ago, 5 months ago actually was an example of this kind of interaction, but I just didn't want to recognize it as such because I've been trained not to, and I've been trained socially and culturally to kind of wave it away and say, no, this isn't what really happened. But also this sense that what's going to happen if I do make a point out of it, that there's going to be social consequences, which can range anywhere from being socially ostracized in your workplace to just the enormous emotional and physical toll of having to share that experience and have people not believe you, to being fired and losing your livelihood.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, all of that's making me think about kind of your feeling, having read it, and then hearing that, you know, it's billed as a dark comedy. There's a lot of laughter in it. Is that surprising you to hear that? What's your kind of take on why humor? And what the humor might mean.
I think that's a really, really good question. I think for me, and having watched a play we were talking about just a minute ago, watching humor function in that setting, humor allows us to do that kind of escape mechanism where we can say, oh no, it's actually not this serious. Ha ha ha, it's so funny. Which actually I think works against the impulse of the work in some ways. Mm-hmm. At the same time, kind of the humor that lets us, as an audience, let ourselves off the hook to be like, if this is funny, it can't be that bad, also creates a little bit of space where we are able to think, well, maybe I'm not responsible or I don't act in this particular way, but maybe people I know do. And then instead of being kind of paralyzed and just like defensive, like, I am not sexist or mm-hmm. I'm not a victim of sexism, the moments of humor kind of create a little bit of breathing room for the audience to relax out of that defensiveness, I think. I think it can be really tough if you are recognizing yourself in those moments or recognizing your experiences as a victim and kind of beginning to process that. The laughter can be, other people's laughter can be really hard because you're like, wait, this isn't funny. Mm-hmm. But I also think that's where really important conversations happen after the fact.
Yeah.
So that when people go home or as they're leaving the theater and are saying, somebody says, oh, I thought that moment was really funny. And the other person is like, actually, no, that sounded really terrible to me. Or that's happened to me and it wasn't funny. Mm-hmm. It creates those moments where people can share.
And have those conversations. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to know, you know, to take a snapshot of the audience to see, you know, this is, I guess, kind of an uncomfortable conversation, but how much of the laughter is happening in the male audience versus the female audience? Mm-hmm. And like, what is that breakdown? You know, because I think my experience of the play, of course, is different mm-hmm. than yours. Even as someone who hopes to be an ally, you know, for me, it's the laughter is dangerous and tricky, and mm-hmm. Heather will negotiate that in rehearsals with the cast. But you know, it's for me, it was this journey in the play from kind of like, oh, it's a humorous boys' club that I'm watching, and I can see myself outside of it. I hope. Mm-hmm. But to a place of reflection by the end of it, of, oh, wait, maybe I'm not so out of it as I thought I was.
Mm-hmm,
and so
exactly.
I think humor is it's working differently, I think, based on the gender of the viewer,
which is
interesting.
And I think it's also working differently based on the experience of the viewer. So
sure.
If you are, and I think that what that experience you just described, that trajectory where you start out and you're like, oh, this is funny. And then as you move through the play, you're like, actually, wait, maybe where am I in location to the in-groups and the out-groups and the powerful and the disempowered, and really having to struggle with that and using your impulse to laugh as a barometer mm-hmm. of that experience.
Wow. We're going to tackle a lot with this show. So, Patrick, you sort of started to get to kind of what I was wondering a little bit more about, because we talked about sort of the female reaction to initial thoughts on reading this story. And I certainly can understand maybe what our female audience members will be feeling. Patrick, I was wondering, and I don't know if I'm allowed to put you on the spot and ask you questions, but
never.
As the representative of all men,
I'm going to be a strong female in this moment
awesome.
Right now, and I'm going
to
could you elaborate a little bit more on how you did react personally to this story? I understand that you saw it first versus mm-hmm. reading it, which I think is probably a different experience.
Oh, you've seen a production? Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, so to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I remember from that production that it was very funny. The rhythm of it, I think the language that she's using and the way that she's kind of portraying the men particularly, it was really funny. But at some point, and I can't remember when, I mean, you'll find it, there's a turn. I mean, there's a turn where you start to see that they're not the caricatures that you think they are, that there is something real happening on stage that is disarming as a male viewer, from my experience, so I'll own my own experience, it was really disarming because at first I thought it was just these broad characterizations of men. And then I think just as the play progressed, it started to feel, I don't know, the realism of the play really started to set in. And, mm-hmm. you know, it may have been, there may have been a turning point in the scene with the two women together. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much in that scene that as a male viewer, that was shocking to me, because I don't know, I'm not privy to those kinds of conversations between colleagues where it's just two women speaking with each other. Because if I'm there, I'm there. So then it's different. Mm-hmm. There's a different dynamic. So that's, I think, a moment where it really started to turn for me into like, oh, this is not like, I mean, this is a terrible phrase, but it's been used in the lexicon in the last couple of years, right? This is not just locker room banter or talk or whatever. It's like got consequences. Mm-hmm. Like even if I am, or like in the play, you know, play has many scenes with just men, like two men talking with each other. And whatever we're saying and however we're behaving in those moments and those meetings carries over mm-hmm. into interactions with other people. And so I think I was really struck by that too. Like, oh, it's not just about when women are present. Mm-hmm. There's a need to behave. It's like wherever I am as a human being, like that's the things that I learn and participate in carry forward. Mm. And that's kind of the danger of locker room talk. I'm using air quotes. You can't see me podcast, but yes.
Oh, that spillover effect is, I mean, that's a really interesting takeaway from seeing those. I didn't even think of what it would be like for a male audience member to kind of have insight into those female interactions. Certainly those scenes were some of the most painful for me, especially with the work that Claire and I had done through our all-female Titus Andronicus, mm-hmm. and really digging into those female relationships as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have any thoughts about kind of the difference between those interactions and maybe kind of the dynamic between scenes that were all male or scenes that were all female.
Yeah, I think I really want to underscore the powerful truth of what Patrick said about what happens in the scenes just between men carrying over. I think it's really important to recognize that. And that's actually one of the things I'm hoping folks will walk away from the play with, so that when you're in those one-on-one or same gender situations and somebody makes a sexist joke, instead of laughing at it because you're like, oh, it's just us guys, or it's just us male identified people, actually be like, that's not cool, because it's in those same sex spaces where folks are feeling like, oh, this is where I'm free to be who I am. This is where I can be a real man. I don't have to be on my best behavior. And in some ways, I'm gesturing back to the kind of very stereotypical, say, 50s style of manhood. Like, I don't smoke in front of the ladies because that's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. But I think that same sense of, well, I can tell blonde jokes or sex jokes when I'm with my guy friends, and not think about what that means about the relationships that I have with women, and the fact that I can tell a blonde joke to my guy friends has these ramifications for women as a category, the women in my life, and those moments where, in this instance, men intervene to say, no, that's not okay, become so powerful, because it's not about appearance. It's not about following these external rules or being politically correct. And I'm also using a bunch of air quotes. but it's really about, these are the things that are okay or not okay in terms of how we are human together. Hmm. I think in terms of the scenes between the Janice and Eliza, yes, they were so incredibly painful. To me, they were painful in the context of recognizing the different ways that folks have to, for whatever reason, negotiate their own disempowerment. So Eliza has chosen to challenge it and call people out on it, and she's getting battered by her male colleagues because of that. Mm-hmm. She's being told that she's bad at her job and that she's an unpleasant person to work with. Janice has chosen, for reasons that the play doesn't quite give us explicitly, chosen more to kind of go along to get along, whatever that idiom is, has chosen to accommodate herself to this system because it's the one that's going to let her survive unnoticed and, in theory, undamaged. But I think what's really important to me to think about is that to think about how damaged Janice actually is, even if she doesn't have the same kind of scars and bruises as Eliza does, that she's had to, we were joking before the podcast started, she's had to be a collaborator. And I think about how corrosive that can be to your psyche, to have to collaborate in your own harassment, in your own disempowerment.
Mm-hmm. It's more compromise of who you are than true collaboration.
Yeah.
But that's what you have to do in order to to still seem as valid in this environment.
Right. Or just to avoid being made fun of.
Right.
Or avoid being not invited to lunch. Avoid being not given projects.
Right. Yeah. In this case, Janice gets to work.
I mean, she has to pay a lot of dues. She has to pay like 5 years of dues, but eventually she gets to work. But again, it's under these kind of really reduced, constrained circumstances. Mm. And not to get too melodramatic, but there is this part of me in reading the script that was like, who could Janice have been if she had ended up in different circumstances, if she'd made different choices about how to situate herself in her workplace, which is not to blame Janice. I think it's really important also to recognize that she's in a really difficult position making shitty choices, and to recognize that she's doing the best she can at the same time that we acknowledge the loss that she's seemingly chosen for herself.
I think that's an incredibly valid point, and I think that that's going to be a significant challenge for the actor that does get to play that part of how is that this is not a weak woman. This is a woman that has adapted to the environment that she is in
order to... And it's not as simple as saying that she's weak or she's bad because she wants to join the boys' club, but that she's complicated. Like an actual real human being.
Right.
So funny how it boils down to that so often.
Oh, we have so many dimensions. So we've talked about a number of conversations that could come from our audience members as they exit the theater. I'm curious about your thoughts about, you know, specific to sexism in the workplace. What do you think is maybe not the conversation, but maybe the conversation that you are hopeful will come from our audiences seeing this?
I think there are really like 17 conversations, and if folks get to three of them, I'll be thrilled. I think recognizing the proximity of these dynamics, that this is not something that happens over there, and it is not as stereotypical as forced fondling, that it also includes things like deciding who gets to work on what projects. I think Patrick's point about what men do in spaces when they're alone with each other, and folks thinking about if they're male identified, how can they change their participation in those spaces? And if they're female identified, how do they change their participation in female only spaces, whether that's and this came up in the Titus production, whether that's in terms of being a little skeptical when you hear a female colleague described as bossy person, or thinking a little bit harder about whether you believe when somebody says, I had this experience and it made me really uncomfortable, instead of being like, oh, I'm sure you misinterpreted it, or I'm sure he didn't mean anything by it. Actually being like, that sounds really, really like a horrible thing, and what can I do to support you? So I think that's like five of the 17 conversations. I think one of the other conversations that I would like folks to have, And this is in my grand scheme of the world is made of unicorns and ponies and endless supplies of leftover Halloween candy. That folks begin to think about how do we change our culture. Some folks talk about this in terms of the difference between complying with laws and actually living out the spirit of those laws. So it's great if your university, if your institution, if your workplace has a non-discrimination policy. And so you're like, okay, these are the things that I can't do. But instead of thinking about these are the things that I can't do because there's a rule that says don't do them, think about what are the ways that I can change my everyday behavior that those things would be unthinkable, that it would be beyond the realm of imagination for me to try to trade work for sexual favors or exclude somebody from a conversation or a meeting just because I didn't think they were competent on the basis of their gender. What's tricky about that one is that it requires people to think really carefully about how and why they make decisions. So why am I not including person X in this work project? Why do I never seem to go to lunch with person Y, even though I go to lunch with everybody else in my unit? And it requires a lot of kind of willingness to look at yourself and think about how you as an individual, we all as individuals are embedded in systems of social inequality and that replicate discrimination.
That's a really important point, that day-to-day, how am I contributing to this problem? I think that if we even get a few of our audience members to walk out and ask themselves that question.
And sometimes it can be, how am I benefiting from this in a way that doesn't require active decision-making on my part? Mm-hmm. So why is it that I always get invited to lunch and this other person doesn't?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, Claire, any final thoughts or something that, you know, as Patrick and I enter into this project that we must consider and think about as we embark on telling the story?
I completely expect this play to eradicate sexism and patriarchy.
I am on it.
Okay, good.
Got it.
I can trust you. I mean, I think one of the unfortunate and yet fortuitous kind of alignments of the stars is it means that this play is going to come into production at a moment when this is a conversation that's happening really publicly. And so I think helping folks think about what's the connection between the play and those conversations over there.
Claire, I am grateful that you exist in this world and that I get to work next to you through these incredibly important projects. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I really, really enjoy working on these projects. It's a nice break from reading policy descriptions.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to our second podcast in support of our production of What We're Up Against by Teresa Rabeck. I hope that you enjoyed what Claire had to say and that it has piqued your interest in seeing the show. As a reminder, the show opens January 12th and runs through January 28th, and it's being hosted at Peace University in their Leggett Theater as our Gaddy is still under construction. We have one more podcast with Senator Jay Chaudhary, and we hope you'll give that a listen. And thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you at the theater.